This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Well, I'm not going to talk to you about menopause tonight. I'm going to talk a little bit about the periodic health exam. And I'm a general internist. Actually, Ralph is also a general internist. So a lot of what we do is related to the periodic health exam and related to providing care for prevention and early treatment. So I have really nothing to disclose. I get salary support from the center, a little bit of salary support from the Center for Healthcare Value, but no support from any other organizations. So let me start with a couple of definitions. The American College of Physicians says that a periodic health exam is a visit with a healthcare provider to assess an asymptomatic person, with emphasis on asymptomatic, so a person with no real symptoms, no complaints, to assess their health and their risk factors for preventable disease with the delivery of preventive services based on your age, your sex, and your other risk factors. Perhaps a better definition, or at least an easier to understand definition, comes from that universal source of knowledge, Wikipedia. So it's a visit to a general practitioner by well-feeling adults on a regular basis, which generally involves taking a history, doing a physical exam, getting some laboratory tests, and then providing preventive services. So let me ask, how many of you have had an annual health exam in the last year? Whoa! The average in the U.S. is about 30% per year, so you guys are way up at the top of this curve. And why not? Why shouldn't you? The CDC, for example, this is a CDC website that says regular checkups are really important. It's time to take charge of your health. Schedule an appointment with your healthcare provider and discuss screenings and exams you need and when you need them. Why are they important? Well, really the idea here is that regular health exams will help find problems before they start. They can also find problems early when they're more treatable and therefore cure before the disease is extensive. I mean, this is just the idea of, you know, if you have a car, you don't wait until it breaks down to have regular maintenance, right? And for many years, this was the standard of care in the United States and Canada. Actually, not in Europe, but in North America, it's been very standard of care to get a periodic health exam, usually annually. Well, here I want to tell you a little story. So this is a story of a real patient. It's not HIPAA protected because it was published all over the national news media. So this is a guy named GWB. Some of you will guess who this is. A 67-year-old man who was in really great health. He had no known risk factors for coronary heart disease. He was really active, golfing, working out in his gym almost every day, and really regularly riding long, going for long trips on his mountain bike. Shortly before his annual physical exam, he led a 100-kilometer bike ride for wounded veterans, war veterans, at a Central Texas ranch. He had no problems during this, no chest pain, no nothing. As a former president, and I'm sure you all now know who he is, he had a routine VIP, very important person, presidential health exam at the Cooper Clinic in Dallas. This examination included a wide variety of history and physical and tests and so forth. I'll show you a bit of a list of this in a minute. But at any rate, he had a stress test where, you know, you walk on the treadmill, and there was a little bit of an abnormality on that. It didn't look exactly normal. And he had no symptoms during the walk on the treadmill and went to a high heart rate level, and otherwise it looked pretty normal. But they sent him for a CT coronary angiogram, which is where they squirt dye into your coronary arteries and use a CT scan to see if there look like any abnormalities. And yes, indeed, there looked like there was a small abnormality in one of his coronary arteries. So he was immediately transferred the same day to Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital, where he had an angiogram, the real angiogram, you know, where they squirt dye into your heart and take fluoroscopic pictures of that. He's up to lots of x-ray, lots of radiation by now, by the way. And there was an abnormality, they described it. They didn't see how much of a blockage, so we don't really know. But he received a stent in what we think was probably his right coronary, which is, you know, typically a fairly minor coronary, and he was discharged with a diagnosis of coronary artery disease and prescribed aspirin, clopidogrel, which are blood thinners, both very dangerous if you want to ride a mountain bike. So here's a guy who is really healthy, totally asymptomatic, walks in for his annual physical, which is way over the top, as I'll show you in a minute. But he goes in for his annual physical, and he walks out with a diagnosis on two medications, which he'll be on for a long time, and all of the sort of everything associated with that. So I tried to get the elements of the presidential physical exam from the White House. In fact, we contacted the White House several times, and they did not respond to us. But there are various commercial companies who provide a presidential physical exam, and these are the list of things that's included. All right? So the examinations and tests include a history, and would this be recommended based on evidence-based practice? Well, yes, having for your doctor to know your medical history, your surgical history, and your medications is indicated. Basic measurements like height, weight, body mass index, blood pressure, heart rate, temperature. But they also do pulse oximetry, which is to see how much oxygen you have in your blood, measure body fat. Routine eye exam, slit lamp exam, dilated ophthalmoscopy, visual field testing, audiometry and tonometry of the ears. So I bet you a lot of you haven't ever had any of these tests. Fiber optic nasal laryngoscopy, which is looking into your throat and with a fiber optic scope. Carotid ultrasound, which is an ultrasound of, you know, your carotid arteries to see if there's any narrowing there. And these tests, chest X-ray, pulmonary function testing, abdominal ultrasound, where they, you know, sonographic study of the abdomen, colonoscopy, which is indicated every 10 years, a resting EKG, echocardiography, ultrasound of the heart, coronary calcium score, prostate-specific antigen, which is not only not recommended, but is recommended against. Comprehensive blood test, fasting lipids, C-reactive protein, blah, blah, blah. So almost all of this stuff is not recommended. But this kind of sounds good, right? If this is what the president gets, why don't we all get this? So the question is, why should we not all get whatever tests we can possibly get? And there are several reasons. The first one is that there's really no evidence of benefit from the vast majority of these tests. There are a few, which I'll sort of come to in the end, which have been proven to improve your health. The second, though, is that there is evidence of harm from these tests, which I'll talk about a bit more. Sometimes tests give you inappropriate reassurance, right? So if you have, say, a pulmonary CT scan and everything looks good, maybe you decide you don't have to stop smoking. But I think more importantly are the false positives that occur with tests, the incidental findings that you find primarily with imaging tests, and then overdiagnosis. And finally, you can imagine what that presidential physical exam costs. And if we had to do that with all 320 million Americans or so, it would be a huge burden. So this issue of no evidence of benefit, there have been several systematic reviews, that is where somebody goes to the medical literature and finds every single study ever done related to this topic, and they found 21 studies of the periodic health exam showing that it did improve a few tests that are indicated, like pap smears for cervical cancer screening, cholesterol testing, fecal occult blood testing, which is an older test for colon cancer. And there was also a systematic review that found 16 studies looking at a general health check, which actually provided data on whether or not what its effect was on your health. And in those 16 studies, there was no effect on overall mortality, that is your risk of dying, on your death from coronary disease or from cancer, and no effect on any morbidity, hospitalization, or disability. So that's pretty much all the data there is for evidence of benefit for periodic health exams. Again, with a few specific exceptions that I will get back to. But let's talk a little bit about the potential harms now. So the first one on that list was false positive tests. The definition of a false positive test is the test says you have a disease, or you might have a disease, but you really don't. That's just a false positive test. And the fact of the matter is that no test is 100% accurate. The other fact of the matter is most people, asymptomatic people who are having some kind of routine test, don't have any disease. That's why they're asymptomatic. So if you think about this, let's say we do a routine urinalysis at your annual periodic health exam, and we know that urine analyses are positive just by chance in about 5% of asymptomatic people who don't have any infection in their urine. In fact, this is true. That means that if 100,000 people go and get a periodic health exam, a regular health exam, and get a urine analysis, 5,000 of those will be falsely positive, and all 5,000 of those people are likely to get treated. And you can multiply that by tens, right? If we did this in a million people, we'd have 50,000 false positives, and so on and so forth. This is a sort of a basic fact of how one of the problems with screening tests. All tests are a bit inaccurate, and if you do a whole lot of them in people very unlikely to have a disease, then most of the positives are going to be falsely positive. Here's a specific example of false positive tests. So screening for lung cancer using low-dose computed tomography scanning is now recommended for smokers of a certain amount of smoking at a certain age. But if you look at the large randomized controlled trials that were done of this procedure, and you consider 1,000 people who were screened annually for 3 years, this is the screening protocol that was used in these big trials. Of those 1,000 people, 190, that's 19% of them, are going to have a false positive CT lung scan. And 95% of all of those positive tests are falsely positive. So the vast majority of all the positive screening tests for lung cancer are falsely positive. But all of those people, all 190 of those people, will need further testing. For the most part, that further testing is another chest X-ray or usually another CT scan, sometimes a PET scan. And on average, about 40 of those people will get a biopsy or a surgical procedure, which is rather invasive in the lung, and a couple of those are going to have a really major complication. I'll get back to the actual benefits of lung cancer screening in a minute. But as you can see that, you know, this is a pretty, this is considered a useful and an indicated test. But if you're considering getting it, you have to realize that a large proportion of people who get it are going to have a positive scan, and the vast majority of those scans are going to be falsely positive. All right, incidental findings. So we in medicine call this the incidentaloma. So an incidentaloma is a mass or a lesion, that is, it's an oma, like a hepatoma or whatever. It's an oma found incidentally in a person without symptoms or suspicion during a routine physical exam or imaging procedure. So let's go back to President George W. Bush. His positive test was walking on a treadmill. It was a stress EKG. And it's a little hard to tell whether that was really a false positive, like the whole thing was, you know, didn't mean anything, or whether it was kind of an incidentaloma because he's perfectly healthy and you had absolutely no reason to suspect him of having heart disease. In fact, you had a lot of reasons to suspect that he didn't have heart disease. So incidental finding in a person without symptoms on physical exam or imaging. We even have a bunch of names for these incidentalomas. So there are adrenal incidentalomas, pulmonary incidentalomas, thyroid, parotid, pituitary, renal, and liver. And we spend a lot of our time often working up, evaluating these incidentalomas, because once you find them, then it kind of becomes incumbent on the physician, but also the patient's worried, right? I've got a mass in my adrenal gland. I have a small kidney cyst. You know, what does that mean, and how far do you need, and are you willing to go to prove that it's not cancer? Now, these incidentalomas and these locations are, it's vanishingly uncommon that these turn out to be cancer. In the adrenal gland, for example, adrenal incidentalomas, about 1 in 4,000 is cancer. So this is a study of that was done of research tests. So these were imaging tests done for research in people who were healthy. So they were doing these imaging tests for essentially no clinical reason. They were done for research. And there were 1,426 people in this study, of which fully 40% had some incidental finding. at least one incidental finding. And in fact, on average, they had two, because the 567 people who had an incidentaloma, the total number of incidentalomas was over 1,000. They followed these people forward to see if that was any benefit to them and found that six of them had something that we really could treat or treat early or maybe even cure. So 1% had some benefit, and about 0.5% underwent laparoscopy or surgery. That is a very invasive procedure for conditions that were benign. So the vast majority of incidentalomas, incidental findings, come from radiologic imaging and particularly CT scans, and particularly CT scans of the chest and the abdomen. Because when they do a CT scan of the chest, unbelievably, they often grab the thyroid. They, you know, the abdomen, the CT scan of the abdomen gets the adrenal. You know, you're getting the lungs and the CT scan, chest CT, and so forth. So lots of incidental findings from CT scans. Here's another cautionary tale. This one also is has received permission from the patient, because this was published in JAMA Internal Medicine. So this is a story of a man who was in his 50s, and he had a brachial plexopathy, which is a complicated problem, but essentially it causes injury to some of the nerves in the area of the armpit and can cause problems with your hand and arm. So to make sure this wasn't being caused by a tumor in the lung, he had an x-ray. And the x-ray, just a plain old chest x-ray. And the chest x-ray showed no masses, but he had a left pleural effusion with adjacent atelectasis or pneumonia. So atelectasis means the lung's a little collapsed. You might see this for no good reason, or sometimes it's associated with infection like pneumonia. So to follow up that abnormal finding, he had a chest CT scan to evaluate this, which again showed no masses that might be causing his brachial plexopathy. But the left hemidiaphragm was elevated with adjacent atelectasis or consolidation. So the left hemidiaphragm is at the bottom of the lungs, and he again has this atelectasis, this collapsed lung, and maybe a little consolidation, which is another way of saying it looks a little bit like pneumonia. But he was feeling fine. He had no symptoms of pneumonia or COPD or any other pulmonary findings. He really came in because his arm, he had a problem with his arm. So the other thing they found on this chest CT scan were 2 5-millimeter thyroid nodules, 3 pulmonary nodules, an indeterminate left adrenal nodule, a 3.7-centimeter cyst in the liver, and stones in his gallbladder. So now he's like in a world of hurt. And so is his doctor, by the way. So the patient had a mild reaction to the IV dye. So when they give you, most CT scans will have some dye used at the same time so that they can see the organs and so forth better. So he had a mild reaction to the IV dye, and severe reactions to dye can be really severe. So this is concerning. He had normal thyroid function tests, and, you know, an evaluation of this thyroid nodule, and thyroid ultrasound, which showed multiple thyroid nodules. And so the decision was made to just to follow these with recurrent ultrasound of the thyroid. An abdominal CT scan was ordered to look at his adrenal mass, again, with a mild reaction to the dye, even though they gave him both prednisone and Benadryl to try to prevent dye reactions. And this showed a 1.3-centimeter adrenal nodule consistent with a benign adenoma. That's what almost all adrenal incidentalomas are. They're benign tumors called adenomas. So he had a benign adrenal adenoma. A follow-up CT scan of the chest, because he's got pulmonary nodules too, so a follow-up CT scan of the chest showed no growth of the pulmonary nodules. And 2 years later, the patient is just fine, but he had 3 ultrasounds, 3 CT scans, 2 specialty consultations, multiple laboratory tests, and all of this is unrelated to what he came in to see the doctor for. So this is like, you know, there are multiple stories like this, though. I think Dr. Smith-Beinman showed you one of these a couple of weeks ago, where the chair of a radiology department had a CT scan of the colon to evaluate, screen for colon cancer, and wound up having just a whole cascade of incidentalomas and tests and procedures, several of them invasive. So this is just the kind of thing that happens not uncommonly. All right, overdiagnosis. Overdiagnosis is a little bit of a more difficult concept, but what it means is that you were diagnosed with a disease which would never have caused you any symptoms. You would have died or suffered from another disease or other diseases. So if you do autopsy studies, there are many examples of this, but if you do autopsy studies of the prostate gland of men, you will find that the prevalence of cancer cells, if you look really carefully, in those prostates is around about the same age as the man. So a man of 70 years old, if you really look hard at autopsy, he got run over by a bus, died of different problem. About 70% of those men have some level of prostate cancer. Similarly with breast cancer and almost all other cancers. So overdiagnosis is when we assiduously go looking for tumor, every single last cancer cell. We find it, and then we treat the patient as though we label them with cancer. We treat them as though they have cancer, which can be chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, and so forth, when they were never going to have any symptoms related to that cancer. I have to say, you've heard of this too, I think, that some of our great biologists are out there trying to find blood tests, which they say might be capable of finding one cancer cell floating around in your blood. So you could go to the lab and the diagnosis was come back cancer. I think this is probably the worst thing I've ever heard of for this very reason. Our bodies fight off cancer all the time. We're all walking around with some little bits of cancer, and your immune system takes care of it. So finding it at earlier and earlier stage can cause more and more and more problems. How do we know it's overdiagnosis? Well, the way we know it's overdiagnosis is in randomized controlled trials, where big randomized controlled trials. So you take thousands of people and you flip a coin as to whether or not they're going to get some imaging study or not. That's what they did in the lung cancer screening studies. At the beginning, those two groups will be completely equivalent, right? They, at the beginning, if they have lung cancer, they're going to have the same prevalence of lung cancer. And so if you find a whole lot more lung cancer in the screen group than in the unscreened group, that may be because you're finding things early. But if this goes on not to have any impact on mortality, then or morbidity or mortality, then this was an overdiagnosis. So most of this idea of overdiagnosis has come from very large randomized trials where you can compare the two groups who started out equivalent at baseline. Okay, now I'm back to the low-dose CT scan as an example. So among smokers who get a low-dose CT scan to screen for lung cancer, again, we'll take 1,000 people and they're screened annually for 3 years. The chance that a lung cancer, any lung cancer detected by the screening is an overdiagnosis is close to 20%. So about, you know, 1 in 5 of the cancers we find was never going to bother that person. And if you take those whole 1,000 people and you screen them for 3 years, the benefit, the big benefit, is that 3 of those people who get screened, 3 fewer people will die of lung cancer in the screen group compared to the control group. So if you're one of those 3 people, that is a really big win, right? You were going to die of lung cancer, and now you're not. But the flip side of that is 4 people in the screened group are going to be overdiagnosed. So about 1 to 1, for every person we prevent from dying from lung cancer, we diagnose somebody with lung cancer who would have been perfectly fine the rest of their lives and never been diagnosed with lung cancer. This is, by the way, a very big problem because you find a lung cancer, you find a prostate cancer, you find a breast cancer, you have no way in the world of determining which ones are going to go on to cause problems and kill people and which ones are not. We do have some markers, like, you know, we have tumor markers for breast cancer, for example, that some of the markers are associated with more aggressive breast cancers and some of them are associated with more indolent or slow-growing or maybe even benign-type breast cancers. But in general, you just can't tell which of these are going to go on to be a problem and which are not, which is the reason why they all get treated pretty much the same, that is, surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. So all of these data that I've been showing you have led to recommendations by many official bodies that we should not do a periodic health examination. And that includes the Canadian Task Force on the Periodic Health Examination, which I guess they put themselves out of business. the American College of Physicians, the American Medical Association, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, and the Society for General Internal Medicine. In fact, you know, these caring wisely lists of by societies that say things that you should not do or you should think hard about doing, on that list for the Society of General Internal Medicine is the annual health exam. So, has that had any impact on the prevalence of annual health exams in the United States? Well, the answer is no. This is a confidence interval lines, but this is the rate of annual health exams from around about 2002 to 2010. And you can see they stay right around 30-35% of Americans, all American adults, have a periodic health exam once a year. And it doesn't seem to be going down. I mentioned cost as another factor. Periodic health exams are actually the single most common reason, that people go to see a doctor. It's about 10% of a primary care doctor. It's about 10% of all primary care visits, costs about $10 billion a year. And the funds could probably be better used to targeted treatment of chronic disease or treatment of acute diseases. And probably also the physician time could be better used. You know, it's difficult to get to see a primary care physician these days. There aren't enough of them to go around, and their time could probably be better used than conducting periodic health exams. So what recommendations can we make to change this? Well, one recommendation is that we pay for a visit to any new doctor to establish a relationship. And at that visit, the doctor is certainly going to ask you about your history, your medications, your surgeries, and your risk factors for disease, and think about what preventive therapy you need. That we provide preventive care at visits for other reasons. This is what we as primary care docs usually do. That is, you come in to see me for a follow-up for your diabetes, and at that same time, I look on the list with your age and your sex and your risk factors and see, should I order a mammogram? Should I order a should you have a pap smear and that kind of thing. So not as a separate visit, but as part of your routine health care, and again, focused on very specific evidence-based screening for certain conditions. The last one's really important. It's stop paying for annual health exams. Right now, primary care physicians actually get paid more for an annual health exam than they get paid for, let's say, a visit for a complaint. In 2011, Medicare started paying for annual health exams. And, so one way to go at this would be to stop paying for annual health exams, except for the first visit to a new doctor to establish a relationship with your doctor and help them understand your history and medications and so forth. So when else might an asymptomatic adult, like probably most of you, need a checkup? Well, again, as I said, to meet your new physician and provide your health history. To help with lifestyle risk factors like smoking, alcohol, abuse, obesity, healthy eating, and exercise. For family planning and prenatal care. And for other reasons that are based on your individual needs. This includes immunizations, you know, like flu, pneumonia, shingles, and then age and risk factor-based screening for things like cancer and osteoporosis. It's very difficult to do something, a table or something that would show all of you what you really should be doing for screening, because it really does depend on your age, sometimes on your family history, and your risk factors, and your sex, and your lifestyle behaviors. But there are some really kind of nice evidence-based apps that you could get on your phone or your computer to help with this. The AHRQ, which is the Association for Healthcare Research and Quality, they're the people who fund the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. They have an app called EPSS, which is Electronic Prevention Screening Service or something like that. But EPSS, and you can go and put in your age and your sex and a couple of other things, and it'll show you which things the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends very highly and recommends pretty highly for you. There's a really nice one actually put out by Kaiser Permanente, Preventive Care for Northern California. But you have to be a Kaiser member to use it. But it's really pretty, it's pretty slick. So I will now take some questions. Thank you all. Yes? Well, I used that story because it's such a compelling story, and you're right, he did come in with a complaint, but the findings were incidental. He got a chest x-ray in that case for a good reason, because you would like to rule out that this brachial arm, plexus arm problem was being caused by a tumor in the apices of the lung. But the rest of those findings were all incidentalomas. But I think your general feeling is right. The things that doctors can do, both inside and outside the hospital, can inadvertently have great harm. And so going to the doctor for minor complaints and so forth is probably not a great idea. Now, this patient I showed you, I think he really had, if you read the full story, he really had symptoms and needed to be seen. And you shouldn't avoid going to see your doctor if you have real symptoms. But we do see a lot of people who go to the physician frequently for minor symptoms and may wind up with a chest x-ray. That one chest x-ray started that whole cascade that I showed you. Yes. Is there any preventive lab work that would not get you into these situations of false positives and incidentalomas and so forth? Most adults, cholesterol testing is a lab test, and that's indicated usually in women over 45 and men over 35 at least once and then periodically. People who are at risk for diabetes, so that they're overweight or it's in their family, that's a lab test. They're easy tests for diabetes. But I think that's about it. Probably cholesterol and diabetes are the only sort of routine lab tests that are really indicated. You think of anything else, Ralph? No. Yes. Well, see, biospecimen today. Today we're talking about biospecimens in terms of if you go to the lab and you give some blood for like a cholesterol test and some of the blood is left over, many universities and research institutions want to use the remnant of that blood to do DNA testing and genetic testing. I think that's not what you mean though, right?
Well,
what you mean is like one of the tests using biospecimens is fecal occult blood testing or hemocults. So this has been proven to reduce, if you do this annually and follow up on it appropriately, fecal occult blood testing can reduce the risk of dying of colon cancer. It's actually the only test for screening of colon cancer where there's really good evidence that it reduces the risk of dying of colon cancer. There really haven't been big trials of colonoscopy, which is the more common study done. Yes. So she says, there's nothing wrong with me. Why should I go to my doctor? I think you learned something from this whole experience. No, I mean, there are lots of quotes around this, but if you feel healthy, it's very likely that you are. And her question was, if she feels good, should she just skip it forever? Or maybe she should go every 5 years. Well, I think it's worth going frequently enough to maintain a relationship with your doctor. And maybe that's every 3 or 4 or 5 years. I don't know. For people who have a chronic condition, even if it's an easily managed chronic condition, like, for example, mild to moderate hypertension, they usually see the doctor every year at least. And at that visit can then be brought up to date on indicated preventive therapy. If you're totally healthy, you have no medications and no reasons to see a doctor, I don't think you have to go at all, but if you want to go every 5 years, I mean, I think that's better than every year. Yes. That's an interesting question. So should you be taking your own blood pressure at home? I think the answer is no. Because there are many people get very obsessed with this. They worry about it. It may, there's a lot higher chance that you're not doing it properly, for example. And what's happening right now is, you can get an app or a device or a wearable or something to measure almost anything you want. You can measure blood pressure, heart rate, EKG, fitness level. And we've actually at JAMA Internal Medicine received multiple studies looking at the validity and accuracy of these devices, including some well-known ones, which I probably shouldn't name. But they're not accurate. So I think you're probably better off dropping into the clinic and having a nurse measure your blood pressure if it's, you know, if you have some risk factors for hypertension or if you're worried about it. Yeah. So the question is, how did we get to this point where 30% of Americans are getting a periodic health exam when there doesn't seem to be any good value there, where less would really be more? And I think it's actually it's all wrapped up with the whole story of American healthcare. So we just think that if a little is good, more is better. And particularly if it costs a bunch of money, then give me all of it because I don't have to pay for it. And it's just kind of makes sense, right? That if a little is good, more should be better. But I think that's kind of what we're trying to show you throughout this series of talks, is that with regard to healthcare, which can be very dangerous to your health, you want the right amount, and oftentimes less will result in better health than more. And you know, there are all sorts of economic reasons for this. Physicians are getting paid to do periodic health exams. People in Congress think that periodic health exams are helpful and that we shouldn't be denying them to people, so they're pressures for insurance companies to pay for it. There are a lot of reasons in our kind of American healthcare system that push for, you know, more healthcare. Why does Medicare pay for periodic health exams if all of those health organizations say that they shouldn't? I don't know. Actually, Medicare pays for a whole lot of things that are not evidence-based, and oftentimes they wind up paying for them because other health insurers are paying for them. And often other health insurers are paying for them because it's a pass-through. They're just going to charge you more money on your health insurance premiums, and they don't want to be the people who say, no, you can't have this test that you really want or this antibiotic that you think you need, because you'll think I'm just trying to save money, that I'm not interested in your health. So our health insurance companies in the United States pay for an enormous amount of unproven health care. In fact, they pay for quite a bit of health care that's proven to be harmful. And Medicare is on that bandwagon. So they do feel that if other health insurance companies are paying for things, that they should also. So the observation is that other countries do a better job than we do at providing evidence-based health care, and actually in one way or another denying non-evidence-based health care. And that would include the United Kingdom, where they have fairly strict guidelines about what they pay for, Canada, Australia, and many of the Scandinavian countries. I think we're getting a little better. I've been encouraged over the past, 5 to 10 years, that the idea of value in healthcare, particularly if you start from the point of harm, where we really get into a big discussion. If I can say that this thing, you shouldn't pay for it because it's net harmful, but now what if we get to the point where I say, you shouldn't pay for this thing because it's a tiny bit of benefit, or, you know, it's just a little benefit, but it's not worth the cost. Then the discussions become a lot more difficult. So I think we're making some progress, but I think we're kind of a long way from the level of some other countries that do a better job than we do. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.